From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young along with Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Democrats are howling, so are some Republicans, about fellow Republicans' plans to replace the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, with a new American Health Care Act. Some Republicans say it's just Obamacare light, to which the authors reply, it's Obamacare gone. Co-author, Oregon's Republican Representative Greg Walden, defended the plan.
We return power back to the states. We strengthen Medicaid, and we prioritize help for our nation's most vulnerable. Simply put, we believe we have a better way to deliver solutions that put patients, not Washington bureaucrats, first.
But Democrats say it will mean, ultimately, a lot of people losing insurance. NPR's congressional correspondent Susan Davis has been watching today. And Susan, we want to talk about the politics here, but give us the thumbnail, the big differences between this health care plan and the Affordable Care Act. For instance, we know under Obamacare, people got subsidies. There was a mandate to buy insurance. You had to or pay a fee. What about the new proposal?
Well, the biggest changes would be that it does repeal that individual mandate, so the government would no longer tell people that they have to have insurance. It would also repeal the tax penalties in Obamacare and the subsidies it gave people to buy that insurance. And instead, it would replace it with a system of what they're calling refundable tax credits that people would get based on how old they are and how much money they make. And those subsidies would let them buy insurance on the private market or from other sources. It also temporarily keeps in place a lot of the law, most notably the Medicaid expansion, but it would freeze that enrollment in that program in 2020 and eventually try to shift people off of Medicare and put caps on Medicaid after that. Yeah. But it also keeps permanently in place other popular parts of the law, most notably coverage protections for people with pre-existing conditions and allowing parents to keep their children on their plans until they're 26 years old.
Well, but that seems to be the main criticism of the Democrats, that those things were paid for by things like the mandate, the requirement that people buy insurance or pay a fee. And they're also saying that now, under the new plan from Republicans, yes, you don't, there is no mandate for you to buy insurance, but if you do want to go back on insurance after dropping it, it's going to cost you a lot more.
Well, right. And that's one of the criticisms of Republican Senator Graham Paul of Kentucky, as he has said today, it's just a mandate by a different name. Instead of the government penalizing you, your insurer will be able to penalize you if you let your coverage lapse. But instead of that money going to the government, it would now go to private insurers.
Yeah. And aren't there also some Republican governors who've been objecting to this sort of rollback of the Medicaid expansion that came under Obamacare, this idea of raising the bar, you know, who can qualify for government help? We went from very poor to a little less poor. And some Republican governors sent a letter to Republican leadership saying, please, we want that.
Right. And I would also note that the Medicaid expansion in Congress, it's going to be a very complicated part, particularly when this bill goes over to the Senate. Yesterday, four Republican senators from states where they accepted the Medicaid expansion sent a letter to congressional leaders kind of putting the brakes on this conversation and saying they would need much more assurances that what the changes to Medicaid would not disproportionately hurt people who have sought coverage under Medicaid in their state. So that is going to be one of the big fights going forward in this debate.
So what do you weigh in on? First, the Republican side of the aisle. It seems the criticism is coming from two quarters. Some people who are worried that Obamacare, we'll call it that, he did embrace it, you know, in the end of his tenure, that it's actually something that's helping their state. But on the other side of the Republican aisle, you have people saying, as Senator Rand Paul and others did, that it's just Obamacare light, that it's the same old overspending.
Well, the challenges that Republican leaders are going to have now is with among hardline conservatives who, as you said, are referring to this as Obamacare light and just see it as a new entitlement program by a different name. So there's a challenge there to be able to get the votes to pass this in both the House and Senate. And not only from conservatives, but you also have a handful of moderates in the Senate, people like Susan Collins of Maine and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, who have also raised concerns about going too far to repeal Obamacare. And if it were to knock people off insurance, but through insurance coverage in their home states, that they would have a very hard time supporting this. So there's a really fine line that they're going to have to walk to be able to keep enough conservatives on board and to get the votes of these moderate Republicans.
And we, of course, President Obama was firmly behind his plan. Is President Trump expected to be an arm twister in this?
He will have to be. His engagement in this debate will be everything. It will be huge, in his words. Republicans will need Trump not only to sell this plan to the public to get them on board, but he's going to need to help Republicans find the votes to pass it. He's meeting with a group of House whips today at the House. Whips are the people that have to find the votes to pass bills on the floor. The vice president's on Capitol Hill today meeting with senators. The HHS secretary has sent a letter to Congress endorsing the plan. So this is really a full court press effort right now from the administration. Of course, President Trump is a wild card in this, and he has at times differed from Republican leadership on the Hill. But he will need to both stay on board publicly and privately to get these votes.
NPR congressional correspondent, as there is a lot of arm twisting on the Hill today, Susan Davis has been watching this. Thank you so much.
You bet.
Well, as Congress works its way through health care, the president is also calling for a $54 billion increase in the defense budget. Here he is unveiling his budget plans to the nation's governors.
And it will include a historic increase in defense spending to rebuild the depleted military of the United States of America at a time we most need it.
The president has talked a lot about the depleted military, but is it really in such bad shape? Joining us now is Kathleen Hicks, Senior Vice President and Director of the International Security Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Glad to be with you.
And what do you think when you hear the president say that? Is the military depleted?
Well, there's no doubt the United States still maintains the best military in the world, but it's also no doubt that our military is strained today. We use the military much more than we thought we would be doing at this point in time, meaning particularly coming out of the major commitments in Iraq and Afghanistan. And following the annexation of Crimea by Russia, we're out back in Europe as we had never planned to be before. And at the same time, we see on the horizon these major potential challenges, both Russia, but probably more importantly, China and the quality of the military that they are growing. So we're stressed today. And we're stressed about how we're going to manage the future.
But we're still spending far more than any other country on defense. Is it something that more money would help deal with the fact that we're stretched thin? Or does it have to be a change in policy and an end to some of these wars in order to get our military in the shape that the president would like it to be in?
Well, the reality is there are a variety of ways you could manage this problem. Certainly more money is a way to manage the problem. But so too, as you say, our decrease in the operational use of the force, which allows it to reset, meaning you get ships into maintenance, you get troops back training and on a regular deployment cycle. You get aircraft into maintenance. That's certainly helpful. But there also is the reality that of all that money that we spend on defense, much of it is in some ways seemingly untouchable. And so that's why we always add money. So that untouchable includes healthcare costs, just like for the average American or the overall healthcare system. Healthcare costs for the military are growing astronomically. CBO says they grew something like 130% between 2000 and 2012. So they're eating more and more of the defense budget.
But we also always hear about some member of Congress who requires that we spend, you know, billions and billions of dollars on some aircraft that's manufactured in his district. Are those things still a huge part of the military budget?
Right. So you do. Absolutely. You have these other constraints that come in. Look, sometimes members of Congress have very good ideas for how we should be improving the military and the readiness of the force. But there's no doubt that the combination of the military's industrial base being across the country and in every district, and the reality of those members looking to protect jobs and speak for their constituents results in an inability really often to go after programs that the military may decide are past due to be cut.
What about the issue of nuclear weapons? That's something else that we've heard politicians talk about recently, that we haven't done enough for nuclear modernization, that our nuclear capability isn't what it should be. Do you agree with that?
I do agree that there needs to be some modernization of our nuclear force. I think most experts on defense would agree with that. It is a question, as in all things often, of degrees. And I think there has been an ordering for a new nuclear posture review, which is Washington speak for the president ordering a review of how we execute our military missions with regard to nuclear capabilities. That will be important for helping to establish what it takes to deter adversaries in the future, how nuclear weapons play into that in the American arsenal, and then what it takes to keep them, you know, as capable as possible.
So when you hear the president talk about spending another $54 billion on defense, is that, in your view, what it's going to take to get the military to where it needs to be?
I think you have to come back to these questions of strategy. What is it that you want the United States to do in the world? What is the role of America in the world? And then within that, what is the role of defense within a broader national security toolkit? I don't think this administration has laid any of that out. And it's certainly in the way it has looked to cut the State Department, for example, and the U.S. Agency for International Development seems to have a disproportionate focus on military force within that national security toolkit. So none of it makes sense yet in order to even evaluate whether that $54 billion per year is sufficient for what Mr. Trump believes we need in the world.
That's Kathleen Hicks, who is Senior Vice President and Director of the International Security Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Once upon a time, there was a boy born in the mid-60s. He fell in love with rock and roll. It helped him through his parents' divorce. Then when his mother remarried and 9 years later had another son, son number one could share, no, make that force feed, his favorite music to his younger brother. Then brother number one's father also remarried. Soon there was brother number three, born 20 years after number one, who decided he would, in his own words, deliver the same rigorous course of age-inappropriate musical proselytization as I had with brother number two. Well, despite the different generations, different households, different cities, different tastes, music bonded the brothers. Now they've launched a podcast called Brother, Brother, Brother.
You know, so, Wyndham, are you saying that you, mid to late 40s white male in America, have been made redundant by technology and computer-wielding youths?
Yeah, I mean, I do. I mean,
your one skill of music suggestion is
exactly. It's a sad co-opted.
The oldest brother, Wyndham Lewis, joins us in the Here and Now studios. Hi, Wyndham.
Hello.
We're also joined by brother number two, Jeremy Sartori. Hi, Jeremy.
Hello.
And joining us from NPR's New York studios, because he really wanted his own space, is Christian Lewis. Hi, Christian.
Hi there. How are you?
You're the youngest brother, right?
That's right.
Well, let me start with you. 28, do I understand?
That's right.
And your brother, Wyndham, 48?
Correct.
How much you hate it when you're loving, let's see, I'm trying to do the years, the real Slim Shady, and he's trying to make you listen to Stairway to Heaven?
Well, I still love the real Slim Shady, so I actually don't think that I ever got fully past that. But no, I loved it. He sent me sort of a musical care package when I was probably 12 or 13 years old. It included things like Ted Leo and The Pharmacist's Hearts of Oak and Interpol's Turn on the Bright Lights, which is still one of my favorite albums. I mean, I think it really sort of broadened my horizons. I was walking down some dirt old avenue. I was whistling a new song to
myself. Wyndham. You go, guy.
We try.
Yeah, I mean, you're not just talking about Stairway to Heaven.
No, you know, I was an odd kid and we moved a lot, so music was a real grounding thing. I used to listen to American Top 40, Casey Kasem's program, and actually chart the movement of certain songs up and down the charts like, you know, a baseball fanatic would keep score during a game.
Well, Jeremy, you're the middle brother.
I am.
9 years younger. What was it like for you?
I think for me it was about connection. So I was, I'm 8 years younger than Wyndham, and then we also have an older sister. We all lived in the same household, but I was kind of the son of the, you know, remarried parents. Mm-hmm. So I had, you know, to find ways to connect, and one of those ways was music. I vividly remember having a Fisher-Price plastic record player, and Wyndham and our sister Sarah, you know, giving me 45. So my first 45s were, you know, Start Me Up by the Rolling Stones, Shake It Up by the Cars.
Which is much older than you are.
Absolutely, yeah. I genuinely like the music, but I also think the sort of bond that it gave with my older brother was another part that initially pushed me into that and then continued to...
I always say Jeremy was the only kid I think that ever played all four sides of Zen Arcade on a Fisher-Price stereo.
But Christian, the youngest, it also worked the other way. Like, you could bring new ideas to your older brothers. Actually, why don't you start DJ for us a little bit here? Your list includes A Report to Shareholders by Run the Jewels.
You know, I love Run the Jewels. It was something that I immediately wanted to share with Wyndham and Jeremy. I mean, we've got this text chain that's been going for probably, what, 4 or 5 years now? We'll have rolling months-long conversations. I mean, this was one of those things that, you know, that I definitely flagged for them as soon as I'd heard it.
And remind some people, Run the Jewels, they're from?
So LP is from Brooklyn, and Killer Mike is from Atlanta. But these guys, you know, he's sort of the MC, and traditionally LP was a really great producer and beat maker, and, you know, they couldn't be better sort of compliments to one another.
Where are horses? I mean, a horse is a horse, of course, but who rides is important. Sitting high with a uniform, barking orders, the man of order. And I'm scared that I talk too much about what I think's going on. I got away with this. They might drag me away for this.
And so, Wyndham, again, older brother, how proud are you?
Well, it's fun. I mean, this is I never anticipated, and I certainly didn't do this purposefully, but it's nice to reap the rewards of having younger brothers that have their ear to the ground when it comes to new things. Because part of the thing we talk about on our podcast is that I feel a little overwhelmed by unlimited choice, and so it's nice to have someone like Christian or Jeremy helping with the curatorial part of finding new music.
Let's listen to a little more of the podcast. Like, you'll pick something like, oh, in this conversation, musical second fiddles, people who are like second fiddle in a band. Let's listen.
The second fiddle song needs to be a good song, so not, you know, B-side schlock. And we wouldn't want a whole album of it necessarily.
That's a little bit of the Brother, Brother, Brother podcast. Three brothers with different mothers in some occasions, different fathers, but related by their love of music. Jeremy Sartori, middle brother. One of your favorites is The Turnpike Down by the Lemonheads. Now, how would you introduce this to your brothers?
Well, I go a little bit more on feel and time and place. So it's a genre that I really like called power pop. So if I would compare other artists like Big Star or Badfinger and say, you know, this is a more modern take on a genre that we all tend to like.
Let's listen.
I'm lost in the see-through. Pain always needs a battle. Between a one and a
need to. I love it. Turnpike Down by the Lemonheads. It's Jeremy. We're going to refer to you now as middle brothers. Pick on one of their podcasts for his song. But Christian, is there ever a moment where, you know, the two of the brothers might be just saying, really, you know, to a brother's pick?
Yeah, that does happen sometimes. So, I mean, I think, you know, partly growing up in D.C., which neither of the other guys did, I definitely trended towards some of the harder punk and you know, noisier rock when I was a kid. And I think that thread sort of continues in my musical taste now. So there are times when I'll be talking to Jeremy and sharing with him some of whether it's, you know, Girl Band or USA Nails, who we actually just interviewed. You know, and I think it sort of fits really well sort of within my taste and wheelhouse. But by contrast, I think Jeremy sort of trends towards singer-songwriters a little bit more than I do. So
he's nodding. That was not taking a shade. No shade there.
There's no shade thrown here.
Wyndham, you're the oldest at 48. And one of your favorites, let's say something by the Rolling Stones, but you go for Deep Cut, Before They Make Me Run.
Yeah, we just did an episode on Second Fiddles. I think it was referenced a couple minutes ago. There was always one Keith song on every album. And in this case, on Some Girls, you know, the best song on the entire album, as far as I'm concerned, is Before They Make Me Run, the Keith song. So every Stones album has a Keith song. Not every Keith song is the best song on the album. This was the rare occasion when that was the case.
But Christian, again, the youngest, 28, no eye rolling from you?
No, none, I got to say. I mean, I grew up, you know, with a family that had, I think, sort of really pretty eclectic music taste. I think that was a pretty good starting point, and it only sort of grew out from there.
Yeah, Christian and my father was British, so we spent a lot of time, two of us, and actually Jeremy did as well, by virtue of another strange phenomenon, which is that my mother remained very good friends with my father's family. So we all spent a fair amount of time in England growing up. That would be one of the things that I was able to bring to friends in the States, is I would get the British music earlier and bring it over.
Well, okay. Let me see if I can do the whiteboard on this. So,
good luck.
Wyndham and Christian, you have the same father.
Correct.
Wyndham and Jeremy, you have the same mother.
Correct.
Correct.
And Jeremy and Christian are not actually...
We're not actually
blood related. But you're... How would you describe it? You're brothers through music.
We've become brothers through music. I mean, the first time we met was in Chicago at a Pitchfork Music Fest in 2006. And prior to that, I don't think...
Wait a minute. You're in a family together, sort of extended family, but you meet at a music festival.
Exactly, yep. Wow. And so that sort of kicked things off. And then from that, I sort of joined this text chain that Wyndham and Christian have been having. We talked about the podcast, you know, I think starting 3 or 4 years ago and finally got our act together and got it off the ground.
I think that's one of the storylines that I think is really interesting about this podcast is that, you know, essentially Jeremy and Christian are getting to know each other on the air.
Yeah. How great. How great.
It's true, though. I mean, you know, Jeremy's definitely exposed me to some terrific Texas country, outlaw country, which, you know, I sort of had an interest in but not a lot of exposure to, and vice versa. Kraus, one of the artists who we interviewed recently, put out a great album, and Tomorrow is, you know, one of those things that I was able to feed up his way. So it really has been this, you know, great sort of symbiotic relationship.
Let's listen. The other cool thing I'm hearing is you're three brothers who had this love of music and this podcast, which has helped bind the ties, and you're getting to interview people.
Yeah,
which is,
that's
like, what?
It's awesome. It's an added bonus. Yeah,
yeah, childhood dream. Do I see on your list, Wyndham, the Carpenters?
Yes, I'm a massive Carpenters fan.
We've only begun before the rising sun.
Karen Carpenter, one of the great voices in rock and roll, and one of oldest brother Wyndham Lewis's favorites. Wyndham again infected brothers Jeremy Sartori and Christian Lewis with his love of music that led to their podcast, but also their brotherhood. Great story. Thanks, guys. We're going to link you to brother at herenow.org. But a question, did you have an older brother or sister who initiated you? Thank you, Brother John, for Bob Dylan. Let us know at herenow.org.
Hi, it's Jeremy Hobson, and I want you to take a minute right now to think about the people you love. Have they ever listened to a podcast? Do they even know podcasts exist? All this month, we're asking our listeners to tell a friend about a podcast they love. You can do it in real life or on social media, and if they don't know how to download a podcast, give them a quick lesson. You'll be opening up a whole new world for them. Tell us what you're recommending with the hashtag tripod. That's hashtag TRYPOD. And thanks.
And today, Republican lawmakers in Texas propose new legislation that will require transgender people to use bathrooms in public buildings that conform to the biological sex listed on their birth certificate. Of course, this comes a day after the Supreme Court declined to hear the celebrated case of Gavin Grimm, the student who'd won a lower court decision in his request to use the bathroom of his choice. The court, the Supreme Court, asked the lower court to reconsider Gavin's case, given that the Trump administration recently scrapped the Obama directive protection of transgender student rights. Ben Philpott is senior editor at Here and Now contributor KUT in Austin. Ben, that's the climate that this proposed new law comes in Texas. Tell us about Senate Bill 6, SB 6. What would it do?
Senate Bill 6 would bar municipalities and public schools from coming up with a policy that allowed a transgender person to use the bathroom that matches their gender identity. It would also provide fines, penalties for those schools or state buildings that do that anyway. And then, of course, the concern by some is that this then just is barring transgender people from being able to use public restrooms if it's a single-sex restroom.
Well, many voices were heard. The Lieutenant Governor of North Carolina, Dan Forrest, whose state passed its own bathroom bill last year, testified in front of the Texas Senate today. Let's listen.
This issue is not about transgender individuals. This issue is not about the LGBT community. This is not about discrimination. This is certainly not about the economy. This issue is about the fundamental right to privacy of all Americans.
So, Ben, what is the divide from supporters to opponents?
Well, the supporters are pushing on the safety aspect of this a lot. In fact, some of the testimony we heard earlier today were from women who had either been assaulted or had been secretly taped in a women's bathroom, saying that this is about making sure that only the people that should be in a bathroom can be in there. At the same time, Republicans are also pushing kind of the religious moral aspect of this. Our lieutenant governor has put together a collection of ministers from across the state who say they're going to go out to their congregations and let them know that this is something, that this bill is something they should support.
Well, we see protesters carrying signs with slogans like, y'all means y'all. This is outside your legislature there. And let's hear from Rachel Gonzalez, who was protesting the bill and talking about her transgender daughter.
She exists as a girl. She's happy and healthy and it would be very dangerous and very bizarre to send her into a men's restroom.
But Ben, we mentioned the context here with the Supreme Court sending Gavin Grimm's case back to the lower court and saying, look at it again because of the Trump administration directives. Do you think legislators in Texas, in your state, are feeling empowered?
I believe so. There was brief mention of that and, of course, the attorney general's statement today as testimony was opening. And they also within this bill added legislative intent, which, again, maybe they're kind of just getting set up if a lawsuit were to come, if this bill were to pass, to try and point to different things like the attorney general's rescinding of the order and reasons for why this bill should go forward.
Ben Philpott, senior editor at Here Now, contributor to KUT in Austin, will, of course, continue to watch this story as Texas proposes a law that would, some are seeing, go against transgender people's rights. We'll follow this. Ben, thank you.
Thank you.
There's news today that Uber Thailand is facing problems as the government there has begun a crackdown on the service for not meeting regulations. This comes as just a tick in the months of controversies the $70 billion ride-hailing company has faced, including allegations of sexual harassment as well as reports of a secret program used by Uber to avoid officials. Here to explain is our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Johanna Buya is senior editor of transportation for Recode. She joins us. And Johanna, it feels like drip, drip, drip of problems for Uber. Do you see this as inevitable for a company that has expanded so quickly all around the world, having to deal with all these regulators? Or is Uber doing something wrong?
It's a little bit of both. I mean, Uber has long flouted local regulations, especially in its early days. And it's because there is this internal mantra where, you know, you basically have to win at all costs. And that comes from the top, which is the Uber CEO, Travis Kalanick. And that has sort of now extended to the internal culture. It affected things like their HR department, which handles issues like sexual harassment. And so if it's not mission critical, oftentimes the company doesn't feel like it's worth spending time or resources on it, you know, at least immediately. So we're seeing a lot of the culture, a lot of things happening as a direct result of the internal work culture.
And as you look at all of the high-profile problems that Uber is having right now, including those related to sexual harassment, also the lawsuit brought against Uber by Google's parent company Alphabet, and that secret program reported by the New York Times of Uber essentially trying to get around local regulations of Uber, which one is the biggest problem for Uber right now?
I think the problem is the sort of the timing of all of this happening, because all of these are kind of separate issues. You know, the lawsuit that Waymo is bringing against Uber is against, you know, this practically brand new employee that Uber has, and they're alleging that that person, Anthony Lewandowski, who now heads all of Uber's self-driving efforts, basically stole the design of their laser-based radar, which is a crucial part of the self-driving system. And so that isn't necessarily a reflection of, you know, Uber's structure. And then the gray ball issue, I mean, it isn't necessarily news that Uber has, you know, evaded local regulators and local regulations. You know, multiple reporters, myself included, have reported that what's news is that there is an actual program that their legal counsel and their number two, Ryan Graves, who's also the co-founder and on the board, approved that program. And so I think the larger issue here is that there needs to be, you know, a leadership change. There needs to be, and Travis Kalanick, the CEO, has also admitted himself that he needs leadership training, that he needs to grow up. And as the company nears IPO, that becomes more and more pressing.
Do you expect that he will have to leave the company?
I do not, for a lot of reasons. You know, he, for all of his faults, has made the company what it is. He also controls, you know, the board. He, Ryan Graves, his co-founder, is on the board. Garrett Camp, another co-founder, is on the board, and they're fairly loyal to Travis, as well as Arianne Huffington. You know, she is a new member of the board, but she is also kind of on his side at this point.
And have any of Uber's competitors, principally Lyft, but now there are many others popping up around the country, have they made any headway in trying to get people to delete Uber and go with them instead?
So I don't think that they're the ones who are asking people to delete Uber, and I think that's probably really important. Are they riding the wave? I'm sure they are. You know, Uber is as popular as it is for a reason, and that's because their marketplace is incredibly efficient. That's where the riders are, and that's where the drivers are. And if that continues, if there isn't really an effort on both the rider and driver side to completely stop using Uber, then any boost that Lyft, for example, sees will be temporary because there won't be marketplace efficiency. And if a rider is waiting more than, you know, 3 or 4 minutes for a ride in places like New York and San Francisco, they're going to eventually go back to Uber.
That's Johanna Buya, senior editor of transportation for Recode. Johanna, thanks.
Thank you.
And now let's switch gears completely and bring in our resident chef, Kathy Gunst, to talk pasta. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Jeremy.
And pasta is one of those things that we turn to when we're in a hurry, but sometimes you just run out of ideas.
Yeah, today we're going to focus on that scenario we've all been in where you get home from work late, you're exhausted, there's nothing in the refrigerator. How do you whip up a really quick sauce that has very few ingredients but has a whole lot of flavor?
And you tried to do it with 5 ingredients or less.
Kind of, yeah. We're not including salt, pepper, the olive oil that most of these sauces are cooked in, the water that you boil the pasta in, or the grated Parmigiano Reggiano that you hopefully sprinkle on the top. So we'll call it 5-ish ingredients.
5-ish ingredients. And what
gives me a little leeway.
So what are some of the ideas?
So you have what? The roasted cauliflower dish there,
yeah,
with the toasted breadcrumbs and pine nuts.
I'm going to take a bite right now while you tell me all about it.
So at first, a lot of people say, what? This sounds kind of like an odd combination, but it is delicious. You take a head of cauliflower, you cut it into small florets, and you roast it with some garlic and olive oil and salt and pepper. And roasted cauliflower gets very sweet. It develops a beautiful golden brown color. And then what you do is you add some panko or breadcrumbs to your roasting pan and some pine nuts. And you add just a tiny bit of butter on top of the breadcrumbs, and you roast them for about 5 minutes till they get toasty and golden brown. And then you toss all of this with a 1/2 pound of linguine or penne, really whatever shape you like. What do you think?
I think it's delicious. And by the way,
isn't
it's here
great?
With penne, which is one of my favorites.
Penne is a big favorite and something I always have in my pantry. But the breadcrumbs, you find this a lot in Sicily and other parts of Italy. It gives you this crunch and it has a toasted flavor. And I love the way it pairs with the almost butteriness of the cauliflower. So that has been a big winner in my house.
Okay. And right next to it here in front of me is another pasta that you came up with that involves sausage and broccolini.
Correct. So for this dish, you can use broccoli rabe, which is a slightly bitter type of broccoli. It's got a long stem, or broccolini, which also has a long stem, which is a cross between broccoli and Chinese broccoli. Not quite as strong a flavor as regular broccoli. Really delicious in this pasta dish. So here you cut up an Italian sausage. It could be sweet or spicy. And you saute that, a little olive oil, a little bit of garlic, and then you add this broccolini. If you're using broccoli rabe, you want to dunk it into boiling water first, and then chill it, dry it, and then chop it up and throw it into the sauce, because broccoli rabe has a bitterness that's very pleasing if you first dip it into the boiling water, and can be quite strong if you skip that step. In terms of the shapes, there's all kinds of rules that go with what sauce you pair with what type of shape, but I think this sauce works well with anything that you like.
You know,
total main course.
What else this reminds me of is sometimes when you're just making pasta for dinner and you want to do it quickly, you think that you need a big heavy sauce with it, like a tomato sauce or pesto or something like that. This is a reminder that sometimes it's the things that will go with the pasta with very little sauce, maybe just some olive oil, that can make just as delicious a pasta as if you're covering it in tomato sauce.
Absolutely. So both the sauces we've talked about so far are not super wet, moist sauces.
Right.
They're more about highlighting the ingredients. The pasta really shines, and you add a little bit of the pasta water just to have some of that moistness. Adding the water from the pot that you're cooking the pasta in adds a bit of starch to the sauce, and it's a great addition to any pasta sauce because it's a natural thickener, and it also helps the sauce coat the pasta better after you've cooked it. But tomato sauce is huge. It's everywhere. People love it. So instead of the same old, I went into my pantry and I found a really nice can of Italian crushed tomatoes, and I put together a very simple sauce. This is called a puttanesca, where you add anchovies and a bit of the oil from the tin, fresh basil, and capers. If you wanted to add six ingredients and really go nuts, you could add a pinch of crushed red pepper flakes to make it even spicier. But this is like a big, bold, loudly flavored tomato sauce that I adore.
And a reminder that people with no-carb diets have been harmed in the making of this radio segment. Kathy Gunst, our resident chef.
So glad you pointed that out.
Yes. And we'll put the recipes at hereandnow.org. Kathy, thanks as always.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And last night I made one of my favorites, linguine with butter, sautéed smoked salmon, and capers. Mmm.
Trump digs coal. You saw that sentiment on signs at rallies during the presidential campaign as the early candidate and then the nominee promised to put laid-off coal miners back to work and revive the struggling industry. And any day now, President Trump is expected to issue executive actions looking to fulfill that promise. Dan Boies from Here Now contributor Inside Energy reminds us that the president previewed his message during his speech last week to a joint session of Congress.
We're going to stop the regulations that threaten the future and livelihood of our great coal miners.
Trump's pledge from a podium facing all of Congress, eliciting applause from Republicans, including the president himself. The executive actions would do two main things: overturn an Obama administration moratorium on leasing coal on federal land, and start the process of rewriting Obama's signature environmental legacy, the Clean Power Plan, presumably to roll back the plan's restrictions on carbon emissions from power plants. Last year, we spoke with Gail Japp. She's a coal miner in Gillette, Wyoming. She's 65. We visited her windy home outside town shortly after she and hundreds of others were laid off from coal giant Peabody Energy.
So, you know, it's just, I don't know, it's been devastating.
Talk with her now, though?
Hello?
With Trump in office, especially with this upcoming executive order, she feels better.
It's wonderful.
She's working again, running a really big coal truck.
The tires are as tall as a two-story building.
It's a temp job, not like what she used to have. But she is bullish. When I ask her if she thinks Trump's actions specifically will lead her back to full-time work in the next, say, year or two?
Want to know the truth? I think it's going to be a lot sooner than that.
More like a few months.
I think within the next 6 months I'll be back full-time.
Personally, I hope that's the case for her.
That is Rob Godby.
I'm the director for the Center for Energy Economics and Public Policy at the University of Wyoming.
Talking to him about whether things are looking up for coal, well, there are a lot of factors.
Coal has a lot of uncertainty.
But one factor he is pretty certain about, looking at what is determining coal markets right now.
Regulations really aren't making a huge difference.
So let's look at the executive orders expected from President Trump. Overturning the federal moratorium on coal leases. It would happen immediately after the order's release. So ask Godby what effect that's going to have?
No effect.
Now, the Bureau of Land Management points to about 30 projects potentially affected by the moratorium, but Godby says he doesn't know of any just waiting to get started again if the moratorium is dropped. Because cheap natural gas is the biggest thing holding coal down. Wind and solar are up there, too.
Renewables have become much more competitive.
Also, since the Great Recession, we've seen a lot more energy-efficient products like TVs and light bulbs.
So while the economy started growing again, electricity demand didn't, and that just made everything worse for coal.
The U.S. Energy Information Administration says American power generation from coal peaked in 2007. Since then, the equivalent of about 71 coal power plants have been taken offline, leaving about 400 coal plants in the U.S. today.
Unless people start building more coal-fired power plants, long-term, coal demand really doesn't have anywhere to go.
Things continue to look really bad for Appalachia. Lost jobs, closing mines. There are some bright spots for coal in other parts of the country, though, like Wyoming, where Gale Japp works. The EIA says production nationally is expected to climb 5% overall by next year because natural gas prices are expected to go up a little bit. And if Trump guts the Clean Power Plan, the short-term effects won't be big. But look out further, say to 2030. Godby says coal production in Wyoming's Powder River Basin is predicted to be nearly 40% higher without the CPP. Sounds like a lot. But to give a sense of just how far coal has fallen,
that production total in 2030 would be the same as what the production total in the Powder River Basin was around 2011.
Leaving a lot of coal miners still in need of a job right now. Gale Japp, she'll work nights, 12-hour days. She can handle it.
Well, for what they pay me, I dang sure can.
For Here and Now, I'm Dan Boyce.
And Dan's story comes to us from Inside Energy, a public media collaboration focused on America's energy issues. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.